All right, constant listener, this, of course, is the Far Middle Podcast. I am Nick Deolius, episode number 26. Who is our namesake dedication going to be for this episode? I've given us a lot of thought, but I'm going to go with Herb Adderley, the great cornerback from NFL lore. We're going to dedicate this episode of the Far Middle to Adderley. I have to be honest with you, I gave a lot of thought to two other individuals, Wade Boggs and Rod Woodson. And maybe you could make the argument that at least with on-the-field statistical accomplishment, they have a stronger case than Adderley. But again, this is the Far Middle Podcast. We go way beyond just the on-the-field numbers. We get to the substantive issues, tangible on-the-field, off-the-field, root issues, all of the above. And when you look at it across all those different perspectives and views, Herb Adderley is an excellent choice from my perspective. He was the complete person. So he's a Philadelphia native, a Pennsylvania native. That's a good thing, of course. Played college ball at Michigan State. A lot of sports fans and a lot of football fans don't know this about Adderley. He originally was playing on offense. He was a running back, and he did that quite well at Michigan State. So well, in fact, that he was drafted in the first round coming out of college by the Packers and by the great Vince Lombardi to be a halfback. But there was a problem that the Packers had and that Lombardi had to deal with, and I guess it's a high-class problem to have. When he drafted Adderley, he at the time had two guys in the Green Bay backfield by the name of Horning and Taylor. And of course, both of those individuals would end up in Canton, Ohio in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So the Packers were stacked when it came to the backfield and running back. So Lombardi, almost by accident, by experimentation, right, by insight, whatever you want to call it, he moves Adderley to cornerback and give him a try on defense. And lo and behold, Herb Adderley becomes one of the greatest cornerbacks ever in the history of the National Football League. Played, I think, 9 seasons with Green Bay. During those 9 seasons, he wins 5 titles. The Packers won 5 titles during those 9 years. That includes, of course, the first 2 Super Bowls, so Super Bowl 1 and 2. The Packers were in both. They won both. And then Herb Adderley ends up getting traded to Dallas. He becomes a Cowboy. And he became part of that just historic and vaunted doomsday defense. And those Cowboy teams that he played for, they went to 2 Super Bowls and they won the 2nd one. So an interesting factoid about Adderley and his career, if you look at the first 6 Super Bowls in NFL history, Adderley played in 4 of them and won 3 of them. That's a pretty impressive factoid or accomplishment to say that you played in 4 of the first 6 Super Bowls and won 3 of them. And Herb Adderley had reverence, loved Coach Lombardi, not so much when it came to Tom Landry. He was rumored, Adderley that was, to have said at one point, quote, "I'm the only man with a Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl ring who doesn't wear it. I'm a Green Bay Packer," end quote. So it sort of gave you some insight onto where his loyalty sat. And a lot of that might have had to do with the view of each coach when it came to race relations and African-American players. During that era and during that time, Lombardi was much more welcoming and inclusive when it came to utilizing, working with, and putting African-American players on the field. Landry perhaps not so much. And I'm guessing that had something to do with Adderley's feelings looking back on his career and the two coaches. So Adderley, you know, Keystone State native, early NFL pioneer, as the Super Bowl era was just dawning, a really interesting time in NFL history. Key piece of 2 classic NFL dynasties, the Packers and the Cowboys. Hall of Famer, winner. He brought more to the table than just on-the-field numbers. And for those reasons, Herb Adderley is our episode 26 namesake. The theme of the Far Middle Podcast for some time, of course, has been connections and connecting these individual dots. So let's start with Herb Adderley to get things rolling. And of course, Herb Adderley's number was 26. So if we take 26 and we take the reverse of that number or the inverse of it, we of course have 62. And 62 has become a really important and a really troubling number at the same time. And why is that? That's because 62% reflects our current labor participation rate in the United States of America. In other words, only 62% of American adults are either working or looking for work. And if 62% are working or looking for work, that of course means that 38% of American adults are not working and they're not looking for work. And that is a problem because it is much too high of a percentage. Particularly, it's a math problem. The math won't work when you look at things like budget deficit. So if you look at tax revenues from people working and paying income tax versus government outflows, the math isn't going to work. The outflows are going to swamp the inflows when you have only a 62% worker participation rate. When you look at the math of entitlements, same conclusion. Whether it's Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare or any of these other entitlements, 62% labor participation rate, it will not compute. The math will not work with entitlements. You'll reach the point of insolvency sooner rather than later. And then when, of course, you roll that and look at and cumulatively what the impact is when it comes to government debt, same math problem. The government debt with a 62% labor participation rate is going to explode beyond even where it's at now, which is approaching $30 trillion. So why is it that it's not something new, but when you look at the past couple of years, and particularly the past 2 years, we have just seen this striking expansion of able-bodied adults sitting on the sidelines when it comes to working? What's going on there? There's a lot of reasons why we've got this labor participation problem and why it's only sitting at 62%, but all of them are interrelated. They all boil down to a root cause. And if you want to try to boil that root cause down to a word, it would be something like elites. It would be elites in government. It would be elites in academia. It would be elites representing the expert class in both government and academia. And it's basically the symptom and the phenomenon that you see of the few who are setting policies for the many. And those policies that this elite or expert class impose down upon all of us, there's many of them, and they're quite varied. And once again, similar to the common theme with the Far Middle podcast, they may look independent, and they may appear disconnected by themselves on the surface. But when you start to just sort of go a little bit deeper, and you start to peel that onion away, there is a common objective that they all share and strive for. And these collective policies together have a cumulative effect across many facets. And I just want to walk you through maybe a few of those when it comes to these individual, on the surface, individual dots that but collectively are really helping drive that labor participation rate to low levels like the current level of 62%. I'll walk you through half a dozen of these examples. We could go through dozens, but in the interest of time, I'll just give you a half a dozen or so quick hitters to show and illustrate the point that on the surface, these half a dozen might seem to be independent of one another, but cumulatively, as designed, they have that impact together of lowering key things like labor participation. And we can start with the COVID shutdown mandates that basically have shuttered our economies. Government and its friends in academia forcing all kinds of economic activity in the free market to halt. And what and when are being halted is totally subjective to the decision maker. And that's usually someone or something that has no accountability to answer for the impacts of their forced policies. And when they encounter any sort of pushback or criticism or resistance, that's going to be sort of tagged as an attack on science, and you're going to be met with immediate and severe repercussions. Now, when you shutter an economy, or at least the free market piece of that economy, you're going to kill GDP. And GDP, of course, is the engine. It's the lifeblood that fuels work and fuels work ethic. And when you kill that momentum to work, right? What you're suddenly doing is it, call it culturally or just optically, what was the exception, sitting at home and not going to work, has now become sort of the rule. It's become the norm. So this whole issue of the economy shutting down under the auspices of having to deal or manage COVID, you know, despite the evidence showing that it didn't do much to contain COVID, it created a situation culturally and optically where the person who is sitting at home not going to work used to be the exception, but then suddenly they became the norm. And when things become the norm culturally, there's a wider acceptance. It becomes easier to do that across the board for millions of people. Another sort of independent on the surface, but related to things like the economic shutdowns via COVID, is sort of the follow-on effect, which was using the excuse of these shutdowns, right? That was the precursor, which was forced, of course, by government itself, to then inject the drug of constant entitlements into society, or at least into a wider swath of society. So you saw this with unemployment benefits that were expanded and extended. You saw it with these cash payments to every man, woman, and child across the land. You saw it where we were extending the periods of time for all types of entitlements. They just kept extending the runways with respect to it, which of course created more of a permanency and a permanent view to things. And all this injection, all these payments, what did they do? Well, they acted as a drug, a sedative drug, basically, numbing our drive collectively to go achieve, to go out and earn, to get the work. And that made us, of course, more dependent, like any drug will, on the pusher, which is, of course, the government in this case and its elite and expert leaders. Now, these first two moves of shuttering the economy and then the expansion of entitlements across the board leads to the third factor, which I think is the most underrated of all, probably had the biggest impact overall, continues to this day, which is using these government imposed shutdowns and that convenient science that it points to justify it to then shut down our schools. You shut down schools, you shutter huge swaths of the economy, particularly for the middle class and for the working poor. Now, why is that? It's basic, because many workers have kids. And if kids can't go to school, then as a parent, you can't go to work and the kids can't learn at the same time. So students on one side, they're left in the dust because proficiency drops with non-effective remote learning. It produces no return. I think we're just starting to realize the cumulative effect of 2 to 3 calendar school years being remote, so to speak, quote unquote remote with air quotes, and what that is going to do to already troubling proficiency levels in math and science and reading and reading comprehension, English as well. We're just starting to begin to understand the magnitude of this problem. It's made a bad problem much worse. But then on the other side, the other type of damage beyond the student is that the economy can't function efficiently when its workers can't come to work because the workers' kids are at home and need to be supervised. So once again, I think this issue of shuttering schools, coming off of economic shuttering and shutdown mandates and entitlement expansion, I think that perhaps has had the biggest and least understood negative impact on things like labor participation and why labor participation is sitting at a paltry 62%. Another sort of on the surface unrelated but definitely interconnected dot in this series is that the federal government, while all this is going on, is using this as a great opportunity to run up huge spending bills and the corresponding budget deficits in the name of course, pandemic relief and stimulus to get the economy that had shuttered going again. So once again, this elite expert class, it creates the problem with the mass shutdowns, and then it uses it to justify the next steps that it wants to pursue, which is posed as answers and cures, but in reality, it's going to make matters, I fear, much worse. So once matter makes it worse, you see it in things that typically or historically people have always feared. A great example of this is inflation. Since all that spending and all that stimulus is pouring trillions upon trillions of dollars, excess dollars, into the plumbing, I'll call it, of the economy. And when you put that much volume of dollars through an already somewhat fixed set of plumbing that is the economy, prices are inevitably going to go up everywhere across the board for everyone. That's just economics 101. And then speaking of money flow and the economic plumbing in terms of what it can handle, to make matters worse, as if all this wasn't enough, at the same time you've got the Federal Reserve that is piling onto this mess, and its mass is measured also in the trillions of dollars. That money printing press, it's spinning so fast you can't see it. And that, of course, pumps even more dollars into that already overheated situation. What does it do? That drives asset bubbles in things like stocks and portfolios and homes or real estate, everything else you can imagine. It drives those asset bubbles higher, larger. That creates this mirage of what I call paper wealth. So millions of Americans open up their 401ks or they hear about what the house down the street sold for, and they begin to believe that they, because of their paper statements or word of mouth with where the speculative real estate market is today, that they are wealthier than they actually are. That mirage of wealth, it's going to motivate and send people to think they can now magically have the means to retire earlier or sit on the sidelines of the job market and just sort of take some time off. And when these bubbles pop, and these economic bubbles always do, okay, you can go back to the Dutch and tulips a long time ago to show that this phenomenon is nothing new. It always ends the same way. When that bubble pops, people are going to be hit with a double whammy of no job and no money nest egg or portfolio nest egg to fall back on. That's going to be an ugly situation. And I fear that time is looming large as we're approaching it. And then last but not least, sort of the sixth example of this on a surface unrelated, but actually all intertwined impact driving down labor participation. You've got this debate about vaccine mandates and how government is sticking its nose into the private lives and choices of individuals. So when you impose these mandates, when it comes to vaccines, what's happening? A lot of workers are heading for the exits. They're just quitting, retiring, whatever the case might be. And that's creating follow-on inefficiencies in the economy, which is leading to sort of more spurts and stops, and thus a even lower worker participation rate. And again, just to reiterate, I am pro-vaccine, okay, but I'm also anti-mandate. I think people should be free to decide for themselves. It's not government's role to institute that type of a health decision on an individual. But from a vaccine perspective, I'm very pro-vax. So pro-vax, anti-mandate. But these mandates from government are making matters much worse when it comes to labor participation. So we just ran through a quick half dozen, right? We looked at the overall shutdowns, the economic shutdowns that occurred, how that drove down worker participation. We talked about how entitlements were expanded. That doesn't help worker participation. We talked about shuttering schools and how that's really been the hidden secret weapon in a bad way to lower worker participation even further. And then we talked about all of this relief spending and pandemic justified spending, which just drives inflation. And that obviously hurts what the ability will be to see GDP and job growth occur. And then you got the Fed doing their thing with asset bubbles, giving people this mirage of wealth where they think they can retire earlier or sooner or sit on the sidelines longer, which is not true. And then you got vaccine mandates being shoved into everyone's sort of personal decision-making by government. All those things, if you just lined them up and just looked at them individually, they appear to be somewhat unrelated. But when you think about it in a key context of a critical metric like worker participation, it is not happenstance that they're all occurring at the same time because they've been designed by the expert elite class to work in concert. So if government punishes work ethic and it motivates people to sit at home, then guess what? More Americans over time aren't going to work, and that's going to have the intended effect. Then what happens? The American economy, it's not going to properly function, and then we all begin to pay the price. And I think we're beginning to all start to pay the price. When I say lack of strong labor participation rate affects all of us, I mean all of us. You'd be shocked at how this problem manifests itself in all kinds of nooks and crannies of daily life and different walks. And I'll give you just one illustration of this at work by connecting it to our next dot to discuss, which is music, and specifically live music. Even more specifically, the dearth of current live music options. So this isn't, you know, life-altering stuff, but it shows how things like worker participation rate, which is life-altering stuff, affects everything and everyone. Sort of a butterfly effect, so to speak, on a grand scale. So what in the world does the elite expert class in government have to do with the lack of live music? Well, the answer is quite a lot when you start to assess it. First off, realize there is a big incentive to convince musical acts to tour. The biggest is that live performance is where the money is for established acts. So people don't buy albums anymore. Our attention spans have been clipped by social media, and the album, unfortunately, has been a tragic casualty of that. I might talk about more on that topic on an upcoming episode of The Far Middle. And albums are expensive to make. They're expensive to market. They're tough to create, right? You don't just wake up one day and create an epic album. They take a lot of time and sweat and creativity. And there's going to be little demand for them anymore. Well, then if there's little demand for them and it's expensive and tough to do, it's no shock that established acts stop making new music. And song catalogs, in many cases, have already been sold, or they are owned by entities other than the musicians that created the lyrics or the music. So that revenue stream, in a lot of instances, has sailed, and it's been monetized in the past. Some recent examples of that, it's been really interesting to watch how these song catalogs are valued from a financial perspective. But Bob Dylan and Stevie Nicks are two recent examples that they cashed in to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars when it came to their song catalogs. But a lot of artists either never had the rights originally, they signed them away at their inception, or they monetized those long ago. So that sort of revenue stream has dried up. So if there's no money in albums anymore, and if recording right catalogs have been sold, that really leaves live performances and touring, especially for established acts when your audience is going to be a bit older with a lot of disposable income. And it's not a coincidence that prior to pandemic, you saw every imaginable rock act that could stand up and still sing touring. Heck, some acts like Genesis, they're touring and they suffer from ailments that don't allow some of them to stand when performing. Phil Collins can't even stand up anymore. He's performing with Genesis while sitting in a chair. The Rolling Stones, they're another example. They came to Pittsburgh last month and everybody that went to that show was talking about how they still had it. No, they don't still have it. They're pushing 80, for God's sakes. Maybe still are seeing, but they're not going to be the same that they were 40 years ago. Nothing in human life and in nature is the same after 40 years. So these aged acts, they tune down everything because they don't have the voice anymore, at least the lead singer doesn't. They'll bring in backup session musicians to do the heavy lifting. It could be a drummer, it could be guitar players, bass players, keyboards, all of them. And some of these acts, unfortunately, are using AutoTrack and they're running things off of laptops, which to me, that is a crime inflicted on the paying customer. When I hear about that or think that's being the case, I won't give that act a dime. What's the point of that? Just listen to the CD. So the economic reality of established musical acts and the modern era brings me to the specific example at hand that I wanted to discuss. There was a great hard rock band in the late 80s and early 90s named Living Color. Some of you might be familiar with them. They were really talented. They had a great guitarist, Vernon Reid, great singer, Corey Glover. Their singer was also an actor. He was in Platoon. He played a character in Platoon, if you're familiar with Corey Glover. And they sort of Living Color fell into the category of what I would call a socially conscious act. These hard rock acts from the era, they basically fell into three general categories. You had the party good time bands, then you had sort of the socially, politically focused bands, and then you had some that were a combination of the two, a little bit of both. Living Color was in that socially, politically active mold or bucket, and they were really talented, are really talented. So when they announced they were touring this year, I was interested to see if they would make their way to somewhere close by to see if I could catch them live. And I took a look on their website, and I learned that the remaining leg of their tour was canceled. And the message from the band on the website was really interesting to me. It said, I'm going to read you the quote here. "It is with deep regret that we will not be performing on the remainder of the Summerland Tour Fall 2021, plus select headlining shows after September 25th, due to continued transportation issues," end quote. So I read that, and I started to immediately think, what you're now thinking, like what transportation issues? That's an odd excuse to come up with for canceling a second half or the end legs of a tour. What does that mean? I never saw that before. And what the heck is going on here? Well, I did some digging and was rewarded with another frightening example of how the expert elite class, through heavy-handed policies, is deterring achievers and it's killing value creators across wide swaths of our economy. You see, it turns out that the band determined that the economics of touring was being upended to the point where it no longer made a return to play live. It didn't make sense anymore. The risk was greater than the reward. What were the factors that upended the ability to make money from touring, at least this year? It's a parade of what we just talked about. It's a parade of workforce, supply chain, and inflationary issues stoked by all these heavy-handed policies from the government bureaucracy and the expert class. So I'll just run you through a few of them. You can sort of come up with these on your own if you just think about it logically. We'll start with fuel prices. Fuel prices are skyrocketing. That makes bus transport, which is how most of these types of bands get around from venue to venue, way more expensive. And fuel inflation is being stoked by the Fed and its free money press. And it's also being stoked by this epically disastrous energy transition from the cost-effective and the reliable, right, to the expensive and to the unreliable, which is code for going from things like natural gas to these expensive, unreliable forms of power generation and energy generation like wind and solar. Buses are also going to be in really poor condition. Why? Because they've been sitting around in lots for 2 years when government dictated that these pandemic shutdowns were going to stop all travel, all tourism, all touring, all types of activity the buses are used for. And poorly maintained buses, that's going to spell trouble to the tour economics. It's another sort of issue to contend with, another hit to the economics and the rate of return of touring. And by the way, if these poorly maintained buses break down, the ability to repair buses, that's going to be hamstrung because no one can get parts because the supply chain is in shambles in this country. And those shambles have been created by government policies that brought our infrastructure to a grinding halt, sort of threw sand in the gears. And even if you had all the parts and you could afford the gas, the tour economic prospects are going to take a hit when you find out that there are no mechanics working to repair the bus and there's no drivers available to drive the bus. School districts, this is a great example of this, school districts, including the Pittsburgh Public School System, when the school year started late summer, early fall of this year, they delayed openings, not because of COVID, not because of teacher shortages, but they delayed the openings because of bus driver shortages. Drivers and mechanics are the very types of jobs that are vacant and contributing to that low labor participation rate of 62%. And then on top of it, your travel schedule gets all kinds of inefficiencies factored into it when different states and cities and regions are applying a mosaic of COVID rules on attendance and testing. So concertgoers are going to be less likely to commit to pre-sale or even attending a concert, depending on what the vaccination status will be at that venue, the mask policy, if you have to provide proof of vaccination at the site, so on and so on. All these rules make it incredibly painful to attend. That makes the risk of a tour much higher, and that makes logistics much tougher. That makes the chances for a cancellation of a tour leg due to these strange transportation issues more likely. So it's, you can see how this all builds on itself to the point where you get to that Living Keller announcement of canceling the last legs of its tour. And, you know, I thought for a second, well, maybe they're not using buses to get to and from venues. Why not just fly commercial? And I just sort of laughed because that would be even more of a joke, of course, with all these issues wreaking havoc on commercial airlines like Southwest and American to the point where thousands of flights are being canceled. And the flight experience, the commercial flying experience, is one of the most miserable that you can engage in today across our economy. So this is the world today, ladies and gentlemen. It's elites and experts dictating terms to society at large that impact everything and everyone. Living Keller, one of their great songs was titled Glamour Boys. And one line from Glamour Boys stands out, one line of lyrics, which is, "The Glamour Boys have it all under control." That was a line from the song. And unfortunately, the Glamour Boys in the political elite, expert, bureaucratic class, they think they have it under control because we let them control. And until something changes on this balance between government and citizenry, experts class is going to continue to do what it does. And you should expect more disruptions, more cancellations, and more upheavals to things in life far beyond the last leg of the Living Keller 2021 tour. All of this leads us to the next connection, which is the bureaucracy. Whether it be elite politicians, self-described expert class staffers, public union bosses, or academic administrators, as these entities, these individuals have not only exploded in size, but more importantly, they've evolved over the past few decades. This went from a civil servant in name and spirit, that's sort of where it started, where it should have been. It then evolved to civil servant in name only, but really self-serving and partisan in spirit. And now I fear that it's morphed into outright partisan and self-serving in name and spirit today. And the bureaucracy aims to serve the left and transform a fully functioning free market economy into effectively a state-sanctioned and controlled economy. The individual gets replaced by the collective. The human, you see this with environmental zealotry, the human is supplanted by the earth, and the science is eradicated by the common good. The left doesn't want Americans participating at high levels in the private sector. That's why we see the paltry 62% labor participation rate. They don't want the free market to dictate capital flows. That's why you see inflation and free money and massive deficits and supply chain bottlenecks and schools shuttered to protect kids from a virus that doesn't seem to be quite that big of a risk to kids. And the left doesn't want Living Keller to set its own path and tour schedule. That's why they ended up canceling the rest of their tour. This isn't a Democrat or Republican thing. That's sort of unfortunate to say that because, frankly, both parties are falling more and more to the whims of the true threats to all of us, which is the left and the bureaucracy. Make no mistake, the left and the bureaucracy are bosom buddies. because one needs the other to achieve its aims, to retain its gains. And both are becoming bigger and bolder, craving more ambition to decide for all of us what's going to be best. Well, that just about wraps up episode 26 of the Far Middle Podcast. Thanksgiving's coming up upon us here soon. I hope you can manage to get your family together in one place, and I hope that local government and the medical expert class is going to allow it. I hope that the flights your family is going to need to take have pilots and they don't get canceled due to supply chain or labor shortages. I hope you find a turkey and aren't thwarted by the shaky food supply chain, and I hope you don't get gouged too badly on food prices with runaway inflation. Now, all these hopes that I had for you this Thanksgiving coming up, that's quite depressing considering this is America in 2021. Did you ever think that was in the old days our expectations would quickly morph into our hopes today? What happened to us? And is it going to get better or is it going to get worse? Think about the words from the master Milton Friedman. He said, quote, "Why don't governments learn? Because governments never learn. What we need are constitutional restraints on power of government to interfere with free markets," end quote. Well said. Got that right, Dr. Friedman. Twitter, you can follow me at Nick Deolius. Website, nickdeolius.com. Give it a look. The book Precipice coming out January 2022. You can pre-order that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Indie Books. All the links are on the nickdeolius.com website. I will talk to you soon with episode 27.